Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Runyon against the Girl Scouts. Mr. Blonder.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Blonder. Together with Equip for Equality, the National Association of the Deaf, we represent appellant Megan Runyon. We're here before this court today asking that Ms. Runyon have her day in court. The Justice Department, the agency charged with interpreting the Rehabilitation Act, which is the subject of this dispute, agrees that Ms. Runyon should have a day in court. The district court improperly did not dismiss Ms. Runyon's complaint and denied her leave to file a proposed amended complaint, which laid out that the Girl Scouts are primarily a social and educational institution which receives federal funding, which thereby submits them under the jurisdiction of the ADA. I'd like to begin with just a couple relevant facts. Ms. Runyon was 12 years old at the time the complaint was filed. Today she's 14. She has always been a Girl Scout. For 5 years, the Girl Scouts provided interpreter services for her. Those communicative services allowed her to fully participate in all the Girl Scouts activities and become a functioning member of a community. Summarily, the Girl Scouts changed their policy and said, no more interpreter services. That's what brought Megan Runyon to this court. She filed an initial complaint in which she raised issues about the Girl Scouts and this treatment under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. The district court granted a motion to dismiss, which raised the issue of, do the Girl Scouts receive federal funding as a whole? That was the issue framed in the motion to dismiss. In their reply brief on the motion to dismiss, for the first time, they raised issues with respect to an educational or social organization. The district court granted us leave to file a surreply to address those and then dismissed the case, taking judicial notice that the Girl Scouts are about cookie sales and that cookie sales in and of themselves are certainly not a social service. The district court also found that there was a private organization, the Girl Scouts were not subject to the ADA.
Mr. Blonder, let me ask you a couple of procedural questions, if I could. And maybe it's just my confusion about this. But after that decision, you filed a Rule 59e motion.
That's correct.
And I know the piece of paper that the district court entered was called a judgment, but it certainly wasn't a final judgment. And I'm wondering why you didn't just file a 15A2 motion to amend.
Because based on our reading of that judgment and the word judgment there, and as we looked at applicable case law, we believed that Rule 59 was the appropriate way for us to proceed.
Well, you didn't think that you had an appealable judgment at that point, did you?
Well, we thought that we had the choice of either appealing up to this court or seeking to amend. That was the way we understood and interpreted the judgment that was entered by the district court.
And we're talking here about the October 26th, 2012, first ruling on the motion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'm not sure why a separate piece of paper was issued there, because that was not a judgment. That confusion, either I'm confused or there's a lot of other folks confused, right, in this, wound up resonating with, for example, the district judge's later application of the more stringent Rule 59E standard for your efforts to correct those problems.
That's correct.
Which I don't think apply at all. I think it's a 15A2 problem. Let me ask you, do any of the issues in this appeal, as far as you can tell, involve subject matter jurisdiction?
They don't. However, the motion that was filed by the Girl Scouts...
You're right, they don't. Okay. None of them. Let me ask you also, we've got this problem. We know that Rule 15 was amended. The amendment coincided rather closely with Iqbal, which only adds to the potential hazards here. But why didn't you try to just beef up your complaint some in response to the motion to dismiss?
Well, first of all, the original motion to dismiss simply raised the issue of funding as a whole. It didn't raise the other issues until the reply brief.
Well, all you had said in your initial complaint was simply they're federally funded, they qualify under 794, right?
Which was a true statement. They did receive federal funds.
Okay. But But there wasn't any effort to really kind of lay that, to respond or fill that out by amending. You may or may not have had to. I'm just curious as to why you chose to wait.
Right. We believe that the allegation that they received federal funding was sufficient because at that point, that triggers jurisdiction under the ADA. Then it became a...
Please don't say jurisdiction.
We asserted a proper claim under the ADA by alleging that they received federal funding, because if they received federal funding on the whole, they fall within the ambit of the statute.
I thought we're talking about the Rehabilitation Act.
I'm sorry, we are.
Okay.
I misspoke.
And you concede, I think, that your original complaint was deficient as to the scope of coverage of the Rehabilitation Act.
The court made that finding, yes.
And you haven't disputed that.
On appeal.
You admit that the original complaint was deficient to plead coverage under the Rehabilitation Act.
We believe that by pleading that they received federal funding, we fell within the Rehabilitation Act. The district court disagreed, which is why we sought leave to amend the judgment under Rule 59 as opposed to Rule 58.
Okay. I'm asking you your position on appeal. You're not defending the original complaint. I didn't see that anywhere.
No,
in your...
we're not.
Okay. So it was incumbent upon you, once you were on notice, that the allegations in your original complaint were deficient to either amend within that 21-day window that the amended Rule 15 provides, or defend against the motion to dismiss, but then you kind of take your chances that you're going to be outside the window for an automatic amendment if you lose.
Well, but the issue that we're now addressing in terms of the automatic amendment wasn't raised till the reply brief was filed 23 days
after the motion. That doesn't matter. The rule is what it is, and it's your responsibility to comply with it.
Right. And I believe we did comply with the rule. We chose to defend the complaint before Judge Leinenweber. Judge Leinenweber ultimately decided that it didn't state a claim, at which point we sought leave to file an appropriate amended complaint, which contained a litany of specific details with respect to the basis for a claim. So,
although you apparently did not do that until after this judgment was entered, well, which everybody interpreted apparently as a final judgment.
Right.
That may or may not have been right.
As a judgment, even though there was no judgment until March 7, 2014.
Yeah. But it's called a judgment. So
yes. Right. Okay. It was called a judgment, and that's correct. We chose to defend the complaint before Judge Leinenweber. And the rules don't say that if you choose to defend a complaint, you automatically don't have a right to amend.
I mean, yes, that is exactly what the rule now says.
Well, no, I would disagree.
You have 21 days from the filing of a motion to dismiss to automatically amend. If you don't do it within that window, your automatic right to amend expires, and you have to seek leave of court. And yes, that's liberally granted and so forth, but you didn't do that until your Rule 59E motion. And you're not contending, as far as I understand, that that judgment wasn't a judgment, even though it may not have been.
Right.
You don't take that position on
no,
appeal.
No, we're not taking the position the judgment wasn't a judgment. However, we weren't on notice with respect to the motion of a pleading problem until 23 days after the motion was filed, which is outside
that
of the provision.
That doesn't matter.
Anyways.
You've got 21 days, you know, regardless of whether you've been put on notice as to every single deficiency in your complaint. Once that motion is filed by the defense, you've got 21 days to amend, otherwise you lose the automatic right. And you're in the permissive domain.
That's correct. We are in the permissive sphere.
And you're not only in the permissive sphere, because you combined the motion for leave to amend with the Rule 59E motion, and you don't challenge that we're in the domain of Rule 59E now, apparently. You're under a much more stringent standard of review for our purposes, and a much more stringent standard for the district court's exercise of discretion.
We may be under a more stringent standard of review, but we meet that standard of review here. When you take Bausch versus Stryker, for example, Judge Hamilton's case, Judge Easterbrook was on the panel.
Counsel, it does not matter who wrote the opinion or who was on the panel. Opinions speak for the court, and ad hominem arguments are out of place.
I apologize. In that opinion, the district court went so far as, I'm sorry, the appellate, this court went so far as to say, hey, parties should be granted leave to amend once. That's a case post the amendments to Rule 15, and it doesn't impact both the liberality of pleadings the way it's interpreted and the right to amend once as a matter of course. In writing, and I cite to the final paragraph, you know, the issue, the objective of Rule 8 is to decide cases fairly on the merits, not to debate finer points of pleading where opponents have fair notice of a claim or defense. And they rely on Foster in that case. You know,
these are all cases under the old rule.
Again, I just note that Bausch is a 2010 case.
But it applied the old rule.
Right. Well, the rule, you know, we also cited for the court.
What Bausch was applying was 15A2, the
correct.
Liberal right to amend.
Correct. And we also gave to the court Rainey and other opinions with respect to that issue. I mean, here, we contend that Judge Leinenweber erred in not considering the full aspects of the proposed amended complaint. Again, whether we look at it under Rule 15A2 or Rule 59, we still meet that minimum standard because the court's required to take a look at the case. I mean, the court decided it would be futile for us to amend, but in doing so, he didn't consider the panoply of evidence that we presented, including from the defendant's own website, the defendant's own documents, where they define themselves as an educational institution, as an organization providing social services. Even the cookie sales, which Judge Leinenweber took as his basis for his dismissal, the Girl Scouts identify as a financial literacy program, which, you know, provides for girls' education.
B-School for Girl Scouts?
Well, I wouldn't call it preschool for Girl Scouts.
No, B-School.
B-School, sure.
Business school.
A modified business program for Girl Scouts.
Seems implausible, but see a lot of implausible pleadings.
But it goes by the way the Girl Scouts define themselves. And that's what the issue here. The Girl Scouts have never denied that they provide educational and social services.
Right. I'm not sure we can get to the merits of any of this, though, because we've got a civil procedure question here that precludes it, or it seems to me it probably precludes it, because we're evaluating the sufficiency of the original complaint and a Rule 59E motion for relief from the judgment dismissing that complaint, and you don't argue that your original complaint was sufficient.
But I don't believe that we need to make that argument now, because under Rule 59E, the court should
you have to show a manifest error of law or newly discovered facts, and you didn't meet that standard, and that's what the court held.
Right, and we're contending that the court, in not permitting us to file the proposed amended complaint, and
that's afterwards.
Well, but it's important to look at the court's opinion on that, because the court allowed us to file an amended complaint, but the court restricted it to the issue of on the whole.
And you're not challenging that.
No, we're not challenging that, but my point is the court recognized its discretion in permitting the amended complaint by allowing a partial amended
complaint.
Right,
but we don't have that before us.
No, that we do, because we have questioned the court's ruling with respect to allowing the partial amended complaint and not allowing the full amended complaint. That's the issue that we've put before this court. So in looking at it that way, it is squarely before the court and was an issue that we raised below. And again, in the district court's opinion, in which he allowed...
Is there some reason why your brief doesn't challenge the district court's initial ruling that the complaint was deficient?
No, because we were trying to simply focus on the court's denial of us leave the file.
If you were challenging that ruling, none of Judge Sykes' problems would be pertinent, would they?
They might not, Your Honor.
There are lots of ways to win this case. You seem to have chosen the hardest and perhaps the ones that don't work.
Well, again...
Maybe you view that as a great intellectual exercise, but...
No, we weren't looking for intellectual gymnastics or mental gymnastics or to make it
an educational exercise.
Or an educational exercise, even a social service exercise. What we're looking to do is find a way for Megan Runyon to have a day in court. And working with Quit for Equality and National Association for the Deaf, we identified this as the way to do it based on Judge Leinenweber's opinion.
You've put your eggs in the basket where you've provided the most factual elaboration concerning the educational and social aspects of the Girl Scouts. But let me ask, with respect to some of the tactical questions here. The legal questions on the merits are questions of, if not first, then maybe second or third impression. We're not talking about well-worn trails in, under the Rehabilitation Act as applied to private organizations like this. And I'm wondering whether it might not have been perfectly reasonable to say, well, let's wait and see what the district court has to say about how much is necessary here, and learn some things, as opposed to just, it's not like fixing an obvious error, which can be done and should be done very quickly. That's a comment more than a question.
Mm-hmm. I know that my time is up. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Blonder, we've run you through your time, so we'll give you a minute for rebuttal when that time comes. Mr. Casey.
May it please the court. This case is about whether Judge Leinenweber abused his discretion in not permitting a plaintiff to file an amended complaint.
Mr. Casey, yes, why did the plaintiff need to file an amended complaint?
Because the initial complaint was woefully inadequate.
And why was it inadequate? Let me tell you what my problem is. The district court's view seems to have been that the United States federal courts have a system of code pleading in which every complaint has to set out each legal element of the claim and then plead some facts corresponding to that legal element. Is that a fair statement, you think?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Because if you look at the two allegations that tried to establish that the Girl Scouts were under the or subject to Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, there was one factual allegation. Defendants' major donors include the State of Illinois Department of Human Services.
Yes. The complaint did not allege what the district court thought to be a legal element, that is, that they be an educational or social service, etc., organization.
Or they were.
The reason I'm asking my question is that in 1991, this court expressly rejected that approach to pleading. The case is Barthelet against Reischauer AG, which nobody cited. And 2 months ago, the Supreme Court of the United States, in a 9-0 decision, agreed with Barthelet. And they reversed the Fifth Circuit, which had held that a complaint was properly dismissed for failing to plead each element and then put a statement of facts opposite the element. That seems to be a pretty big problem with the district court's approach. It's been deep-sixed by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Your Honor, this complaint, if you look at the complaint, the factual allegation, the only factual allegation to subject the Girl Scouts to Section 504 is that defendants' major donors include the State of Illinois Department of Human Services, the United States Department of Justice, and the City of Chicago through a community block grant. Then there's a legal conclusion that defendant is a recipient of federal financial assistance within the meaning
yes.
of... And that's it.
And we held in Barthelet that that's enough.
Well,
The Supreme Court then held in Johnson 2 months ago that Iqbal and Twombly have not changed that rule. They have not required code pleading in which you have to plead every element and put a statement of facts opposite that element.
And I agree with you. They don't. But
it's good that you agree with the Supreme Court.
Well,
the question is why that doesn't require a reversal of the district court's decision.
Because it does not, well, number one, it wasn't challenged. It hasn't been challenged in this court. Okay, so they've waived it. That's the first question.
Well, everybody's been working under a fair amount of procedural confusion here, but keep going.
Right. The second thing is I do not believe under any of the precedents that this one factual statement is sufficient. They don't say that...
The Supreme Court has held is that you have to plead your claim in a way the defendant can understand it. You don't have to plead facts that prove each legal element. The claim here is perfectly comprehensible, that the plaintiff wants to be in the Girl Scouts and wants a sign language interpreter. That's the understandable claim. It wasn't even necessary under Barthelet and Johnson to mention the Rehabilitation Act. You don't have to say, and here's the legal theory under which we win. All you have to do is plead your claim. Was there any doubt in the Girl Scouts' mind what this claim was as opposed to what the legal theory under which we can win is?
Plaintiff cannot state a claim without
tying it
to a law.
That seems to be your view. Without pleading law, you can't state a claim.
You have to.
That is contrary to the law of this circuit, and more important, contrary to the law established by the Supreme Court.
No, you have to plead facts that put you under that law.
No, you don't. That's the holding of Barthelet and Johnson.
Okay. Well,
and you're not in any position to ask us to overrule Barthelet now that the Supreme Court has agreed with it.
And I am not going to do that.
Mr. Casey,
yes,
do any of these issues have anything to do with subject matter jurisdiction?
Your Honor, you know, the way this case set up, in this appeal, I would say no. Because as an Article III court,
okay,
this court has the ability to determine whether this is, falls under the Rehabilitation Act or not.
Right. So did the district court.
That's correct.
So there's no question of subject matter jurisdiction here.
That's correct.
At all.
So you're grounding your motion to dismiss in Rule 12b-1 was a mistake?
It was. I believe, in hindsight, it was probably an error.
Mr. Casey, suppose the proposed amended complaint had been the original complaint. In your view, would there have been any pleading deficiencies with it?
It's a much closer case. And based on Judge Easterbrook's...
I'm asking you in terms of your theory, your understanding of
the pleading. The pleading standard is fairly low. And so I would say it would probably have met the standard.
So it wouldn't have been futile to try to amend the complaint?
Well, I think overall it would have been futile, but... As for purposes
how can
of
12, those two things for, both be true?
Well, before it would all been futile in the entirety of the case because I don't think they'll be able to prove it. But for purposes of 12b-6, probably not.
That's my question.
Right.
Okay, 12b-6,
probably not.
All right. So I didn't see you in your briefs trying to defend dismissal of based on futility there. Okay, and I guess on the amendment question, my concern is that your position seems to undermine the instruction in Rule 15A2. We all agree, I think, that there was no automatic right to amend after the 21-day period had passed from your motion, whatever theories were raised in it. But we've also got 15A2 telling courts to give leave freely when justice requires. And it sounds like justice would require it if you and the district judge thought the original complaint was insufficient, but the proposed amended complaint was sufficient.
I don't believe so, because that then completely ignores and undercuts the amendments to 15A1B.
And why do you think 59E applies here?
Well, based upon, and I was looking through the... at least the appendix, but there is another piece of paper... out there that evidently didn't get in here that did say final judgment and it said case closed. And I don't know
dated
what we have
when?
It here. In, on the docket.
Dated when?
I didn't see it's dated on that October one, but it's not attached. In the October decision.
Saying case closed?
It said the docket sheet says case closed. Believe it or not, that's what it says.
But we haven't been provided.
It doesn't appear to be, because I was looking through during Mr. Blonder's argument. I did want to address one point that Mr. Blonder...
Why didn't you provide that? The jurisdictional statement in the appellant's brief says that the final judgment was in March 2014.
There was a final judgment then.
There can't be more than one final judgment in a case. Unless we have a completely new meaning of the word final, there can be only one final judgment. So if in your view the date of the final judgment was something other than March 2014, why didn't you alert us and provide the document?
No, the date of, because the judge granted their motion to alter and amend the complaint. So therefore, judgment was entered in October was then superseded.
That's not the way Rule 4 works.
Okay. So then the final judgment would have only been in March, but there was a judgment entered at the time in the docket sheet. The one thing I did want to address, though, is
all that says is that the motion to dismiss is granted. It doesn't, I mean, there was this another doesn't tell us the difference between dismissing the complaint and dismissing the case.
There was another piece of paper. And the
but nobody's given us.
Okay. That's correct, Your Honor. One of the things I wanted to address was Mr. Blonder's comment that he wasn't put on notice. In our memorandum in support of our motion to dismiss, we said, because the Girl Scouts does not receive federal funding as a whole, nor does plaintiff allege so in her complaint, plaintiff must identify a specific program or activity for which the Girl Scouts receives federal financial assistance from which she has been excluded or subjected to discrimination she fails to do so. Plaintiff does not allege in her complaint that the Girl Scouts fits into any of the other categories set forth in Section 504B, nor could she, as courts have recognized that the Girl Scouts and similar organizations are private clubs. Then in her opposition brief, not her SIR reply, she says, plaintiff has alleged and can establish that the defendant qualifies as a private organization which is principally engaged in the business of providing education and social services. Defendant is a program or activity receiving federal financial assistance because it is a private organization which is principally engaged in the business of providing education and social services. Defendant qualifies as a program or activity as it is a private organization subject to 29 U.S.C. 794B3 that is principally engaged in the business of providing education, health care, housing, social services, or parks and recreation. Defendant meets the requirements of a program or activity as defined in 29 U.S.C. 794B3A, Romanet 2, because the organization is principally engaged in the business of providing education and social services. As a result, defendant falls within the statutory definition of a program or activity because it is principally engaged in the business of providing education and social services to its members. This was in their opposition brief. They knew exactly what they were going to do, what they needed to do, and they did not do it.
Mr. Casey, are you contesting whether the Girl Scouts are actually primarily engaged in education, health, social services, and recreation programs?
Yes.
What do they do?
They are a private organization that exists for the benefit of its members to build girls of courage, confidence, and character.
You're not contending that scouting isn't educational.
There are educational components, there's social service components, there's all sorts of other components. There's
health
troop meetings, there's cookies, sales, there's lots of stuff. Lots of stuff.
So why aren't you guys kind of right down the middle of the strike zone of what that definition is aimed at?
Everything perhaps except housing.
Yes. Yeah, that is.
There are tents.
Yeah.
I don't think tents in camp qualify as housing.
Temporary housing, at least. Yes, Your Honor. I mean, our position is that the purpose of this inclusion, the amendments to 504, were to...
We don't start with the purpose of something. We start with its text.
Right.
And I share Judge Hamilton's question. Why aren't the Girl Scouts engaged in the business of providing education? We can even skip health care and housing. Social services, we can skip parks, and then recreation.
Because they are not...
They seem to do all of those things and be very proud of it. Why are you running from that?
Well, I'm not running from it, but the language is principally engaged in the business. And they are not principally engaged in the business of any one of those items. They are principally engaged in for the benefit of their members, which girls pay a fee, so it's not necessarily open to the public, and it's only girls, that to build girls of courage, confidence, and character.
That's education.
That's partly education, but it's partly other things as well. They have troop meetings, they do merit badges, they do... This is an educational experience. You can make anything an educational experience.
No, I don't think so. Not Neiman Marcus.
Well... Maybe not, I guess, unless you're trying to budget, right?
Not the sale of cookies, even, through other sorts of channels. But the way the Girl Scouts run it, it is an educational experience.
It can
right?
be.
Yeah,
but it could be also, it's all sorts of things. But it's not. We're not primarily a school. We don't have to give grades. We don't do what you would normally expect.
Well, what do we make of I mean, I understand what you're saying and why you're saying it, but what do we make of the way the Girl Scouts describe themselves for purposes of the United Way and the combined federal campaign and for federal tax exemption purposes?
Yeah, there are, you have limited categories when you are, I mean, this isn't something you just kind of make up.
There's not a special category for developing girls of curls carriage.
There you go. I mean, that's right. And so you check what is something that we do.
That's the way Congress writes statutes.
That's why we do it.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Casey. Mr. Blonder, we've given you a minute.
Thank you. I want to go back to a question Judge Sykes asked, and I went back and looked in the record as we were going through. In our motion that was filed on November 21st, 2012, which we contend the district court fundamentally erred in granting, we asked for relief under Rule 15 and 59E. So we raised the Rule 15 issue below in Judge Leinenweber in deciding not to.
No, I get that. The question is whether that was a post-judgment motion or not. That's why we're focusing in on what was entered after the motion to dismiss was granted.
So was there a separate piece of paper that actually said case closed?
I recall seeing one, yes, which is why we
raised it. Well, it's not in your appendix.
I don't know. I can't answer that.
If that's true, then I'm really confused. But then we've just got a simple Bausch premature grant of final judgment in response to the first pleading. So
that's correct.
Okay.
But as I said,
at least makes it a little easier to understand, but then I don't understand why it's not there, but I'll let it go.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
For now.
Mm-hmm. I note that my minute is up. So again, I ask that the court reverse and remand mm-hmm. and send us back for further proceedings.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and we'll go to our second case of the morning.